Have you heard about the 2018 study that showed half of prenatal vitamins tested had unacceptable levels of heavy metals? No? Well, now you have. I'm Kat, mother of three and founder of Ritual, the company making traceability the new standard in the supplement industry. I remember staring at my prenatal vitamins and finding all these things I was trying to avoid: high amounts of heavy metals, synthetic colorants, and unnecessary ingredients. So, at 4 months pregnant, I quit my job and started Ritual because I believe that all women deserve to know what they're putting in their bodies and why. I'm so proud of our prenatal vitamin. The ingredients are 100% traceable. It's third-party tested for microbes and heavy metals and recently received the Purity Award from the Clean Label Project. You see, we trace like a mother because, let's be honest, no one cares quite like a mother. But don't just take my word for it. Trace for yourself with 25% off at ritual.com/podcast.
We understand that some of our listeners may be disturbed or suffer some mental illness due to the nature of these episodes. A listener of ours, Rob Lewis, has this message that he would like to send out. Rob Lewis is the founder and manager of the Depression and Suicide Support, Illawarra and Sydney Facebook group. A message from him.
I have been at rock bottom. I have felt no one was there. I have felt alone. I tried to end it all more than once. But now I see when I told people I was fine, they believed me. The hardest part of depression is feeling like if you ask for help, you're going to burden someone you care about. But in all honesty, the biggest problem is people don't talk about depression. Please feel free to share this group with anyone who needs help. That group is the Depression and Suicide Support Illawarra and Sydney Facebook page. Once again, if you would like support, head to Facebook, the Depression and Suicide Support Group Illawarra and Sydney Facebook page. And now, on to the show.
A strange spiralling white light was spotted in the early morning sky over Sydney, with even sceptical witnesses wondering if it was a UFO.
They were last seen on the beach with a tall man. And that's the best description police have ever had of him.
More than 17 years after Harold Holt disappeared into raging surf at Cheviot Beach, his widow has finally revealed his last romantic words.
Docky, terrifying, mesmerising. That's the way a number of Australians have described their alleged encounter with the Yowie.
It's time for the Weird Crap in Australia podcast.
Welcome to the Weird Crap in Australia podcast. I'm your host, Matthew Soul. This is episode 162. And of course, joining me in the co-hosting seat is researcher extraordinaire herself, Holly Soul.
Hello again.
And of course, we don't mention him as often as we should, because in the world of podcasting, there's always engineers, sound engineers and editors. And of course, the third part of the Weird Crap in Australia triumvirate is Blake Kelso. Just a little shout out to remember that Blake makes a sound as good as he possibly can with what he has.
He has to do a lot of work.
He has to do a lot of work, I'm sure. Now, if you are just joining us into this episode, this is part two of the Sydney Cliff murders, where homosexual men may have been thrown to their deaths by gay hate groups. Now, if you haven't listened to the first episode, please go back and have a listen to it, even though I do get a little bit didactic and emotional, just because we all are very close to the LGBT community. I've grown up with people in that community, as has Holly. So head back to part one and have a listen if you haven't already. Of course, if you have listened to it, time to jump into one of the worst aspects of this case, and that, of course, is rampant police corruption or inattentiveness. And honestly, I really don't know which one is worse.
Willful ignorance, I think, would actually be a better...
And again, I don't know which is worse of all three of those options, to be honest.
Last episode, we were talking about one of the inquests into Scott Johnson's death. That inquest created a 439-page report, which is ridiculously long even for a death in a series of deaths.
Yeah, 439 pages in any sort of like royal commission or, you know, some sort of inquest along these lines. It's pretty bloody substantial.
Yeah.
you know, I think I spoke about this on the previous episode, but just for context, if you happen to own a copy of Weird Crap in Australia Volume 1, that little sucker, which is quite a thick book, is how many pages is that?
329 A4 pages.
Wow. So the entire first year of Weird Crap in Australia research, which is condensed into that book, is still smaller than this report.
Mm-hmm. With the new evidence found in this report, Steve Johnson petitioned the courts to open another inquest starting in April 13, 2015. Steve Johnson, of course, being Mr. Johnson's brother. We have a quote here from abc.net from Scott Johnson's saga from the 80s till now.
Detective Chief Inspector Young speaks candidly to Lateline in an exclusive interview in which she accuses Mr. Gallacher of kowtowing to wealthy and well-connected businessman Steve Johnson in demanding another police investigation. Citing the lack of new evidence she has managed to find in support of foul play.
This is exactly the wrong thing to say if you want to remain on the career-making case you're on. You especially should not say it the day the third inquest is announced.
Young was dumped from the Johnston investigation in April last year, April 2015, at the request of the state coroner. Barnes was worried she had undermined public confidence in her impartiality when she gave an interview to ABC's Late Line. On the same day, he announced the third Johnson inquest, in which she vouched for the 1988 police investigation.
And that came, from the SBS Gay Hate Decades.
One thing I want to, we can actually cite precedent on this, mm-hmm. When it comes to multiple inquests. There was a shit ton of Australian tax dollars and police resources put into convicting Lindy Chamberlain.
Mm-hmm. She and then three. Releasing her and then convicting her and then releasing her. And
They did the first inquest and that led to a non-conviction. The second one led to a conviction. The third one then reinstated the non-conviction. You know, so
the fourth very, one determined her actual death.
It's also very inappropriate for a detective to decide what the case outcome is before, you know, really, you know, delving into the case.
Mm-hmm.
You know, she cited lack of evidence. Okay, but haven't you just started working on this?
You can't cite lack of evidence if you haven't actually presented any evidence.
Yeah, it's fair enough to say. You know, one of the points that's raised there is she also didn't want, you know, she felt that a wealthy individual was wielding their power. Just recently, and we spoke about this on a minisode, and I don't want to go into it too much here. Go check out the minisodes on Patreon. Just type in Weird Crap in Australia, you'll find it. Recently, a politician has been enveloped in a scandal because they may or may not have used the police inappropriately. Now, to suggest that police are not beyond being bought in any single country, it's not even particular to Australia, is fanciful in the first place. But I'm not quite sure how, I mean, like the suggestion that because he was wealthy meant that he had influence on the Australian police, especially considering he wasn't an Australian citizen.
He was American.
I'm not quite sure how his wealth played into this. And I'm not like, you know, if I'm wrong, I'm wrong, but I'm just not sure how that statement is factually correct.
I think her idea is that because he's wealthy, he can buy time with the politicians. And that's what actually happens in Australia, whether we like it or not.
That's what happens in every single Western democracy around the world.
It happens in the Eastern too.
I mean, if you have a few dollars in, that's what lobbying is called.
It's literally lobbying.
Coca-Cola around the world pays lobbyists to give donations so that they can get, you know, airtime with politicians.
You think Bezos and the American president are just friends? No, Bezos pays to be there.
Absolutely. He paid to be there so much that Amazon now has nearly complete monopoly over America's defense infrastructure when it comes to the digital frontier. That happens because they have money.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, like it's, I guess if the suggestion is he had money that he could be a lobbyist, I mean, it's a valid point, but then, I mean, you could say that about any lobbyist, like the, you know, grieving parents who push for justice for their child. could be in that same category. So it's an odd statement to make, and I can understand why at the time the state coroner felt that she had already biased the investigation before it had really even started.
Young's position in the cases was dubious to begin with, at least in all the stuff that I've read. This can actually be summed up in my immediate gut reaction to this quote.
Chief Inspector Young, when asked on the ABC's Late Line last year whether the original police investigation was flawed, said, "Not at all. It was to the standard of the day." That is and I understand exactly, Holly, why you zeroed in on that quote. One thing that we have seen, this is historical fact. It's not fiction. It's not conjecture. We're not making it up.
We're not rewriting history.
Very, you know, which again, a very succinct point there, Holly. When we looked into the family murders, which was part of our first year of doing the We Crap in Australia podcast.
44 to 46.
There was more than enough evidence to suggest that any crime that had a maybe a homosexual element to it was dismissed. There were even suggestions that police in Adelaide had participated. There may, as we go further into this, there may all be the same suggestion here. Now, standards change. Each generation is more progressive than the last. That's just how society evolves. Mm-hmm. The 1980 standards for police investigation was not great. We have found this multiple times. There was mass corruption. There would be a royal commission into the New South Wales Police Force. There may eventually be a royal commission into the Victorian Police Force. There was also a royal commission into the Queensland Police Force. There were a lot of commissions into police corruption.
And the territory. And the territory. West Australia and South Australia. Everyone had a corruption inquiry in the 70s, 80s and 90s.
The Chamberlain case really highlights the failing of Australian police and the potential corruption there. No organization is above reproach, in my opinion. And I honestly mean that. Even the most noblest of organizations you can come across, charities, for example, everyone should always be under scrutiny, and that way we keep everyone and ourselves in check. So if her argument was, well, it was done to the standards of the day, well, we know that 1980s police standards were far from what we would consider appropriate and proper today.
There's two parts to the quote, and one will cancel out the other. Was it flawed? No, it was to the standards of the day.
Yeah.
She is ignoring the fact that the standards of the day were flawed.
Yeah, absolutely. And that the assessment of, you know, flawed police investigation, well, you know, we see that in a lot of cold cases. We see that in serial killer cold cases. A good friend of ours, investigating journalist Nicole Overall, who has the Capital Crime Files podcast, may have accidentally unearthed a uncaught serial killer here in Canberra. One of the parts of her investigation was that at the time, no one wanted to acknowledge the idea that there would be a serial killer in Canberra.
No one really wants to acknowledge it now if it happens. So back then, definitely not.
Yeah, you know, even now she has plenty of detractors, but there, you know, there is substantial evidence for that. The police around the world, police here, are made up of people. People are fallible. People are flawed, which means that we have to keep an eye on each other.
And go back and check.
Hold each other to account.
Hello, it is Ryan, and we could all use an extra bright spot in our day, couldn't we? Just to make up for things like sitting in traffic, doing the dishes, counting your steps, you know, all the mundane stuff. That is why I'm such a big fan of Chumba Casino. Chumba Casino has all your favorite social casino-style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere with daily bonuses. That should brighten your day a little. Actually, a lot. So sign up now at chumbacasino.com. That's ChumbaCasino.com. No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus. Hello, it is Ryan, and I was on a flight the other day playing one of my favorite social spin slot games on ChumbaCasino.com. I looked over the person sitting next to me, and you know what they were doing? They were also playing Chumba Casino. Coincidence? I think not. Everybody's loving having fun with it. Chumba Casino is home to hundreds of casino-style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere, even at 30,000 feet. So sign up now at ChumbaCasino.com to claim your free welcome bonus. That's ChumbaCasino.com and live the Chumba life. No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
Scott, I really don't like this person.
Scott's third inquest was launched December 13, 2016, making Scott the only one of two persons to receive a third inquest in Australia, with the other, of course, being Azaria Chamberlain.
I'm glad I remembered that correctly. Episode 15, we did that.
That was a long time ago.
Jesus, that was 3 years ago?
Yeah.
Wow.
Witnesses to the original scene were brought back to testify and give evidence regarding what they'd seen. Now, I actually found a highlight I thought was really funny.
Mr. Agus questions fisherman Brian Butson about his thoughts on finding Scott Johnson's personal items, knowing he was gay at a gay beach. Mr. Bunsen says he could not have known Mr. Johnson was gay and did not know what a gay beach was. He tells the coroner, as far as I knew, a gay beach was a bunch of guys singing YMCA. Now, if there is not a more Australian man on this planet than that guy, I don't want to meet him. And honestly, that is one of the most Australian things. Can you only imagine you are sitting in front of a formal setting, a coroner is asking you questions to determine if a crime has occurred on a very serious nature, turns around and says, are you aware of what was considered a gay beat, sir?
And he goes, as far as I knew, a gay beat was a bunch of guys singing YMCA. MCA?
I mean, like, Jesus Christ, like, does that not sum us up as a people or what?
Willful ignorance. That's a term that's really good. Other evidence came to light, sending police leads they'd yet to investigate in the matter, which wasn't hard considering how little they'd actually investigated to this point. However, it was later refuted by a 45-year-old witness who claimed he was being set up that he wasn't actually a skinhead and never went gay bashing when he was accused of it.
Yeah. Now, if you're not aware of the unfortunate term gay bashing, we also covered it when we covered the family murders. It was the practice of gathering up with a bunch of people, trying to find someone who they thought was homosexual. Often they'd misidentify people as well. And they would collectively beat the shit out of that person and then steal their stuff.
Sometimes throw them in a river and kill them.
Yeah. It's what happens when you dehumanize part of your community. If you treat them and speak about them as if they're less than human, take away some of their rights or not acknowledge their rights in the first place, it emboldens people to do these sort of things.
Now, the not skinhead also claimed it was soldiers that regularly went out gay bashing from the Army School of Artillery, which was actually based nearby. And if anyone knows a bunch of teenage soldiers that go out on the drink, early 20s soldiers, they know exactly why he would point them at that.
Mm. It's a very, we've covered both the heroics of Australian soldiery and we've also covered the not so heroic actions of Australian soldiery. I can speak to this a little bit. I've been acquainted with people who are soldiers. I have a family member who was a soldier for mm-hmm. many years. And I can say without a doubt, the best soldiers are amazing people.
Mm-hmm.
The worst soldiers are horrifying villains.
The worst soldiers are Julian Knight.
Yeah, exactly. Well, I only finished re-editing that chapter in Volume 2. It's funny that you should bring him up. Julian Knight was a psychopath who wanted to join the army to kill people and then got kicked out of the army and went and killed a bunch of people. And that is the problem. It's always going to be, when it comes to any sort of organization, is, you know, you've got to keep your bad elements in check and you got to get rid of them as fast as possible. It's kind of interesting watching a neo-Nazi point a finger at a soldier, though. Like, it's a bizarre situation.
But remember, he said that he wasn't a skinhead. So he's not a neo-Nazi, but in this quote, he is identified as one.
Yes, most people refer to this witness as a neo-Nazi. Now, we have a quote here. A witness tells the inquest that a group called the Narrabeen Skinheads bragged about assaulting an American faggot around the same time Mr. Johnson died. The statement says the gang chased him into the bush and that bashing had occurred on a Friday night about mid-December 1988. Mr. Johnson died on Friday, December 10, 1988.
So there's every chance that, yeah, that it, what did happen, but there's also the chance that they were misidentified as skinheads.
Yeah. And, you know, one of these things as well, when you look at a historic case like this, and, you know, when you're looking at about 25 to 30 years passing, the waters get real muddy real quick.
The waters get muddy after a week, like 30 years, fuck.
Well, I mean, I've been on rants on it before. The human memory is one of the most fallible things you're ever going to find. It's absolutely ridiculous. And I always use one of the my fun little games to play with you guys as you're listening. Can you remember what you were doing at 3 p.m. last Tuesday? Now, if you can't, don't feel bad. That is human memory.
I actually can.
What were we doing?
But it's a fluke.
Were we playing Fortnite?
I was going to get lunch.
We had lunch at 3 o'clock last Tuesday?
Yes, we did.
What do we have?
KFC.
Did we?
Well, I wanted to get KFC and then that didn't work. And then we wanted to get Red Rooster and that didn't work. So I ended up going to McDonald's.
I can't even remember that.
It's a fluke. If you ask me next week, I won't have a fucking clue what happened this week.
But yeah, you know, that's a fun little game to play. Just try and recall some recent details of your life. Some people
breakfast
can't even.
Breakfast 2 days ago. Good.
Yeah.
Unless you have the same thing every day, you're not going to know.
Exactly right.
On November 30, 2017, a verdict was returned that renewed hope for Scott's family.
Manner of death. Mr. Johnson fell from the cliff top as a result of actual or threatened violence by unidentified persons who attacked him because they perceived him to be homosexual.
And that actually came from the inquest papers. I went and found them. With this finding, the case was referred to a specialist investigative team, not containing Detective Young, which commonly worked with cold, unsolved cases. They continued to conduct inquiries into the circumstances of his death under Strike Force Welford, the fourth Strike Force so far for this case, under Detective Chief Inspector Yeomans. Police Commissioner Mick Fuller upped the reward for info to $1 million on December 9, 2018, 30 years after he died. A man came forward during this time, admitting he acted as a gay lure in the area so his mates could attack them. This was corroborated by the fact that some of his named accomplices were convicted of gay bashing in the 1980s. On March 18, 2020, in the hopes of luring in information, Steve Johnson matched the reward police were offering, bringing it up to $2 million. He was hoping that the reward would bring justice for his brother. We have a quote here from the New South Wales Police site.
One of our greatest challenges has been facing a wall of silence, but we are starting to break through. At this time, we are currently following some very specific lines of inquiry. Essentially, we believe that given the culture of gay hate at the time, the events surrounding Scott's death would have been likely bragged about. This means there are two potential groups with information: those who were involved and those who were told.
Take a skip back to 1980s Australia, those of you who were alive, because I definitely wasn't.
I was.
You were two when the 80s ended. It doesn't count.
No, it does count. I'm sick of people telling me that.
What happened when you were two?
I remember a white light and a man in white.
Well, that's a lie because Australian doctors wear blue. Masculinity in Australia has been defined through beer and violence.
Mm.
That is mainly what Australian masculinity is. They go out to the pub and they start a fight.
Well, you look at the icons in the 1980s, especially through the lens of pop culture.
I remember saying something about this last week. Go on.
Yeah. You know, you've got your Crocodile Dundees, you've got your Mad Maxes. There is a tenet of, you know, what people would describe these days as hyper-masculinity or toxic masculinity. You know, thankfully I think it's also disingenuous to paint everyone with that brush in the 80s. My parents were children of the 80s and very progressive. They were born in the 60s.
Which means that they're in their late teens, early 20s in the 80s.
Yeah. I came around 1988.
Mm-hmm.
Right. I think mum was... I don't fucking know. At any rate.
Sorry, Helen.
Yeah, sorry, Mum. But at any rate, I'm not really apologizing for anything. I just can't remember how old Mum was when I was born. You know, they were extraordinarily progressive people. You know, we were not raised with hate. You know, no, me or my siblings, we weren't raised with hate. A lot of the people that I knew, you know, quite well were not raised with hate. In fact, it's kind of funny thinking about my peer group. one of my best friends as well. His brother is a gay fashion designer.
Mm-hmm.
My other friend was gay,
mm-hmm.
and you know, all of our parents were born around the same time and lived through this era. So yeah, you know, it's like any society of any time. You're going to have people who are very progressive and want society move forward. You're going to have people who are very socially conservative and want society to stay the same because that makes them feel comfortable because everything's familiar. And I mean, look, you know, your parents fit into that same age bracket. Mm-hmm. Very progressive people. Like, I've never felt that they're not progressive people.
They have their moments, but they're far more progressive than I give them credit for.
Yeah, absolutely. So yeah, it's again, you know, you've got to be so careful with generalizations. And I think,
okay, let me specify in my brain. What I was thinking of was 18 to 25 boys in that era were mostly beer, violence, and football.
Yeah. I mean, is that a little bit more specific? Yeah, yeah. That is fair to say. Absolutely. But, you know, we've also got a lot of like 1980s musos who listen and a lot of 1980s nerds who are probably like, we were the ones being beaten, man.
Look, 1980s nerds, you guys are the ones that came up with the Australian stereotype of the sweaty, rugged man in leather.
Can you absolutely tell that I am petrified of social media?
Just turn it off, man.
I have become such a fucking flip-floppy,
yeah,
wishy person.
Yeah, it used
person.
To be me. Now I'm like, yeah, you know, I don't care.
Yeah, and you're just like, fuck it. You know, every man.
Bring it on, man. You're only spreading me around.
Every man in the 1980s was a thug. Like... We've definitely flipped positions there. Anyway, but that's not what we think. It's just, you know, it would be silly to say that the 1980s male was the most progressive person of all time, or female. You know, there were just as many women who bought into the idea of the rugged, masculine, Crocodile Dundee man.
Or the footballer.
Yeah.
The reward money ended up working. At 8:30 a.m. on May 12, 2020, Scott White, a 49-year-old from Lane Cove, Sydney, was detained out of interest for Scott's murder. They searched his home nearby and took him into custody. An informant broke and revealed to police what they knew. On January 28, 2021, Scott White pled not guilty to the charge of murder. He was remanded until the trial could be scheduled, and on March 5, the trial was said to be on shaky grounds, as the court had to actually determine if evidence was admissible.
Yeah, I could imagine that this would be bloody tricky. The reason being is that huge amount of time,
mm-hmm.
and one confession from one person is not enough evidence. And like, it's really, really difficult. When you're looking at this, let's look at it pragmatically, okay? You're someone who's been accused of a crime.
Mm-hmm.
The only evidence against you is someone else's word, which essentially means that between you and them, it's an argument of credibility. That's why when you're building a case against someone, you generally need a lot of corroborating evidence, or you need other witnesses to come forward who also can share similar experiences. The burden of proof is very, very difficult. And for people who believe in justice, like myself, no doubt wrestle with that. But the reason that the body of evidence is so important, the reason that you need that, is because we also don't want to send innocent people to jail. That's why the system is a lot of the way it is. And it's a very bitter pill to swallow.
Yeah, you're glad for it when it's not you, but when it is you, you're like, oh, thank fuck.
100%. 100%.
Now, the pretrial hearing for Scott White is actually set for July 12th. So the day that we release this episode, next episode is the day of pretrial. So I won't be able to tell you what goes on.
No, but we will circle back to this.
Yeah, unfortunately, our time machine from our t-shirts and that's in the shop, so we'll have to like update this in a mini-sode.
Well, even what we might do, normally our mini-sodes are only for Patreon, but what we might do is a special, like, just quick mini-sode follow-up in this so you guys can get the full story.
Or I'll label the title, like, you know, episode 205 brackets update of case 161.
Yeah, yeah, we've done updates before, so we'd probably do that again.
Just keep an eye out. Now, as this case is still in line to go before the courts, details about how and why the police arrested this man are fuzzy. One detail is that they were watching White for a while in regards to the case. This wasn't just a spur-of-the-moment jump.
Hello, it is Ryan, and we could all use an extra bright spot in our day, couldn't we? Just to make up for things like sitting in traffic, doing the dishes, counting your steps, you know, all the mundane stuff. That is why I'm such a big fan of Chumba Casino. Chumba Casino has all your favorite social casino-style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere with daily bonuses. That should brighten your day a little. Actually, a lot. So sign up now at chumbacasino.com. That's chumbacasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
Step into the world of power, loyalty, and luck.
I'm going to make him an offer he can't refuse.
With family, cannolis, and spins mean everything.
Now, you want to get mixed up in the family business.
Introducing The Godfather at chumbacasino.com. Test your luck in the shadowy world of the Godfather slot.
Someday, I will call upon you to do a service for me.
Play the Godfather, now at chumbacasino.com.
Welcome to the family.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply.
And that we can make that conclusion from this quote. Neighbor Natalie Walster says Mr. White spoke to her a few months ago about the investigation. He said to her, he just said, I've got two detectives on my case about a murder that happened in the 80s, but I didn't do it. Don't have it in me, Miss Walter recalled. She said she saw the three detectives looking through the man's house on Monday morning. He's always been good to me. I can't say anything bad about him. He's always minded his own business, she said. Which, of course, is something that everyone says about every serial killer they have ever lived next to.
Yeah, I'd like to remind everyone of Leonard Warwick.
That Jeffrey Dahmer bloke, you know, he was such a quiet neighbour. Yeah, because he was eating his neighbours.
Steve Johnson, as you can expect, was absolutely ecstatic about this event.
For my three kids, who never got to know their uncle and admire him, not just for his brilliance, but because he courageously lived his life the way he wanted to.
That is all we have on Steve Johnson. However, we do have some of the cases that started coming up as a result of the investigation into this. So we're actually going to start with a couple of these cases because they are fascinating. So while it's great to think that the police got their man, it's not true for most of the gay hate killings that took place around Sydney in the decades before Priscilla Queen of the Desert opened a whole new generation of people to the possibility of sexual fluidity and tolerance. Now, that's just stupid considering Australia in the 80s was represented most famously by two rugged men dressed in leather.
You love bringing that up.
I do.
Do you have a leather fetish?
No, I just think that it's fucking hypocritical.
Do you want to have sex with Mel Gibson as Mad Max or Paul Hogan as Crocodile
Dundee? No, both of them are ugly and old as fuck, so no thank you.
It's just you keep bringing it up.
Because I think it's fascinating and hypocritical that Australia's like, yeah, we're awesome and we hate gays, but look at our two gay icons.
Is that because you believe in the stereotype that all gay men wear leather, Holly?
No, it's because I believe that Australians are fucking hypocrites.
Why? I gave that to you just then.
They hate gays, but they like their gay icon pop culture.
Why are they gay? Because they wear leather.
Why are you doing this?
Because I like to... What I'm doing right now is I'm creating a word trap, and Holly is walking into it, which... you've been doing most of our 10 years together,
which
actually.
Is why instead of falling into it, I asked, why are you doing it?
She just stops it now before it even starts. Why do I do it? Because I'm a shit stirring bastard. Anyway, keep going. Rugged leather men were our pop culture icons at the time.
I'm going to go into a few details of these killings here, some of which may be gay killings and some of which definitely are, but all of them have points of interest. Some of them are connected to previous episodes and some are connected to each other. Most of them remain unsolved.
Mm. So Scott Johnson is, you know, he is the most famous aspect of this case.
Thanks to Steve Johnson dragging his name through the press trying to get it solved.
Yeah, thanks to his brother's push to try and, you know, reopen the investigation. Where it gets complicated is now that opens up this whole kettle of fish, and some amazing reporters, like the reporters who worked for SBS, I hope they won some of those journalist awards because they absolutely deserve them for the work that they've done.
You're thinking of Rick Fenley?
Yeah, Rick Fenley. Well, Rick Fenley worked with the SBS investigators as well, the investigative journalists. Regardless, this is what real journalism looks like, and it makes me very proud of these people being, you know, someone who believes in justice and correcting past atrocities. I absolutely commend these people for the work they've done. They unearthed a potential 30 victims possibly connected to roaming hate gangs. And what we're going to do now is how many have you looked at? We're going to look at maybe 8.
I read through all 35, but in here so far there's 6, maybe 7.
7 that really stood out for you while you're researching this. So that's what we're going to do now. We're going to widen this out. You know, is this just one isolated gay man being thrown off a cliff, or, you know, if a conviction happens? Or is this bigger? You know, is this an organized a hate group attack? There is evidence to suggest there is. And, you know, let's take a look at some of the most infamous cases.
In episodes 44 to 46, we touched on the grand old Aussie tradition of intolerance towards men who would rather look at a dick than a pair of boobs, or those who would be happy to have both on the same person. What?
Now, I'd just like to point out, Holly didn't actually get this script to me in time, so I didn't edit it at all.
This is my pure unfiltered opinion.
Yeah, so we're back to, I can't remember what the last script you completely wrote was, but yeah, we're back to that. So any of that sort of language that you would, this is not me. Just putting it out there.
He has not dulled my pen. Pen is mightier than the sword. Now, that was the 1980s. In episode 7, The Backpacker Murders, we touched on the bias that still existed to a lesser extent against lesbian couples in the legal system and what angles some lawyers were willing to take in an effort to get their clients off a rape charge in the 1970s.
Yeah, when they did, to remind everyone of that, when they defended, when Ivan Milat's defense lawyer was arguing a defense for him, he suggested that because they were lesbians, this was about 3 years ago as well.
They were lesbians, so any violence against them was something they were asking for. That's what the bias was seeing.
Yeah, it was like they would have.
They were lesbians that didn't count.
Yeah, they were lesbians that didn't count. Was it? I can't remember the quote off the top of my head, and I don't want to misquote it. You can find that quote in Volume 1 of Weird Crap in Australia. That's ridiculous. We co-wrote a book, and I can't remember the fucking quote, which is in the book.
Oh, no, you can't remember 12 words out of 140,000. How dare you, Matthew?
Get the book off the shelf. Anyway, we'll move past that. But yeah, you're right. There was an inherent bias towards homosexuals in the legal system.
We even covered the topic, if very lightly, in the context of Captain Moonlight's burial in episode 24, The Holy Bushranger, which was the 1880s.
Yeah. It was, you know, we consider it a fact that Captain Moonlight was Australia's gay bushranger. And, you know, there was a petition to eventually have his remains resettled next to what was most probably his partner.
James Nesbitt.
Yeah.
Australia is nothing if not consistent in its attitude towards the other. That's why, really, we shouldn't be surprised that in the 80s especially, there was an effort by young people, mostly boys, some girls, to eradicate and punish the gay men who dared to find company in their area. True to form, it didn't even matter if the victim was gay. Sometimes they were just people walking alone at a scenic spot, or just stumbling down the street after a night out.
You know, another connection too, when we were talking about the Body in the Barrels murders, the Snowtown killings, they did something very similar where they would look for what they considered signs of pedophilia, and whether they could confirm that person that they were attacking was a pedophile or not, they murdered them anyway.
Mm-hmm. It was the attack on the other.
Yeah.
John Russell was out celebrating with his friends, a going-away party, on November 24, 1989. The 31-year-old barman had just inherited $100,000, which was a shit ton back then.
Oh, yeah.
And was heading to the Hunter Valley to build himself a house on his father's property.
He'd probably also just seen Batman at the cinema. Michael Keaton Batman. Hey, Michael Keaton's coming back like next year as Batman. They're filming it right now.
Matthew's jumping in his seat waiting for it.
I grew up on Michael Keaton Batman.
Russell was drinking with friends at a Bondi hotel the night of November 23rd. He left the hotel at some stage and walked off, too inebriated to drive. His blood alcohol was 0.255, with the legal limit being 0.05, which makes him five times over the limit.
Okay, I've never understood that. How much alcohol is that? I've never bothered to look up.
So it's if you grab a liter of blood, there's 0.255% is alcohol.
Okay, well, I've definitely been up into the fours.
A quarter of a percent will be alcohol.
Okay,
if that helps.
What kills a man?
I think it's half a percent, but I'm not 100% sure because I've never gotten that drunk.
I've definitely been up to the fours. I have to have been. Or maybe that's the death limit.
And I don't know at what point your stomach gets pumped. Now, this was unfortunately the last reported sighting of him when he left the hotel. His father, Ted, arrived at his home to pick him up the next morning on November 24 in order to drive him to the Hunter Valley, only to find that his other son, Peter, was waiting for him. Peter informed Ted that he'd just come from the morgue. John was dead. John's body was found in a rock pool at the base of a cliff near Marks Park, less than a kilometre south of the famous Bondi Beach, to the south of Sydney Harbour on the morning of the 24th. There were rusted pipes located very near the body, some of which could have been used to inflict the injuries presented on him. Police took one look at the man's blood alcohol content and decided he'd gotten drunk and fallen from the cliff. Case closed.
Case closed. Got drunk, fell down a cliff.
Fucking due diligence. His brother Peter would later claim that there were blonde hairs found on or around John's left hand, clenched in his fist, which would make the presence of those hairs indicative of a defensive action against persons unknown.
Yeah, I'd be wondering too if defensive wounds were mislooked, were looked over.
Mm-hmm. What, with their whole like 30 seconds of looking at the blood alcohol level?
Yeah, well, that's one of the things. Like if, now what would happen with modern day policing here is the hair fibers would be tested for DNA.
Mm-hmm.
They would then match it up against the DNA register of known criminals, and then they would go from there.
It's 89, so DNA is not a thing yet.
Not even fucking close to a thing yet. No, you're 100% right there. The first instance of DNA used in a trial would be that of O.J. Simpson, but people at the time didn't quite understand it, and that's why he got to walk away free. And we know that he is...
He is mumble.
I'm always worried about getting sued. You can tell that too. I'm terrified of everything lately. So that's what would happen to this day. The fact that he had hair, someone's hair in his hands, the fact that that was dismissed is absolutely unreal.
However, not unprecedented. The same thing happened with one of the Malat victims.
Yeah.
And only to find out it was her hair.
Yeah, the thing about it is that right there you've got some interesting evidence, because if you can then, okay, so you're looking for someone with blonde hair, narrows it down. You know what I mean? Like mm-hmm. it's a good starting point. Obviously, there are millions of people with blonde hair. Like you're not going to solve it on that alone. But if you find other evidence that suggests a good suspect, and that suspect is a blonde, well,
with the same length hair, a thing too.
You're on the right track. So that's highly peculiar that they didn't worry about that detail.
Peculiar, yes. Unprecedented, no. Detective Pamela Young, of previous fame, in charge of Strike Force McNamara, later claimed that the hairs were along the back of his hand, not clenched in his fist, and were thus not evidence of an assault. By the time of Operation Tarrandale in the early 2000s, however, the evidence was lost completely by the New South Wales Police, preventing any form of forensic testing on them. Roots would indicate that they were pulled. No roots would indicate they were shed, where they died, how long they were, was there salvageable DNA, all these questions.
Yeah, we've talked about this as well. One of the problems is, when it comes to evidence, is storage of evidence. A lot can happen between 1989 and 2021.
Mm-hmm.
Massive, massive things can happen. Officers can be moved. Work relocated. Think about your own offices. How often have you lost a document maybe that was really essential and you've again, I know, and it's probably sounds strange coming from someone like me who's very, you know, anti-authoritarian, and I don't like corruption, and I'm not really a big fan of the government, I'm not really a big fan of the police force, but in this case, you know, I don't think anything sinister is going on here. I think this is just mishandling of evidence which has disappeared over a span of 30 years. It's really not unheard of and pretty common.
When we did the Somerton Man episode, we covered how some of his stuff had vanished at the same time from pretty much the same reason, fires, floods, yeah. People just throwing it out.
Just disappears over time. Yeah.
When undertaking her investigation of the man's death in 2005, Deputy Coroner Millage threw out the accidental death cause and sent police back to reinvestigate, along with a pair of cases where gay men were bashed in the same area within a month of John's death. One of the victims identified his attacker as a member of the Bondi Boys, a group of young people who went around beating up lone men, or men in couples, that they found on the Tamara Bondi Walk. With that knowledge of the other cases, police immediately turned to suspect the Bondi Boys of either hurting or throwing John from the cliff. Unfortunately, his death remains unsolved with a $100,000 reward released in 2015.
And as we talk about a lot of these cases where there is no resolution, however, there is a reward, I absolutely emphatically believe that people know what happened. And if you know anything whatsoever, please, please pick up the phone and call Crime Stoppers. Send an anonymous, send an unnamed letter, anything. Make some sort of form of communication. It must be weighing on you to know what you know. And, you know, these people deserve justice.
Yes, they do.
So, you know, if you know absolutely anything at all, these investigations are ongoing. Please, please do the right thing and make sure that that information finds its way to the hands of police.
While not specifically tied to John Russell's case, the Bondi Boys themselves were linked to a lot of gay bashings in the area. On December 18, 1988, three youths surrounded a lone man near the Bondi Iceboats Club. They demanded to know if he was gay, and when he answered in the affirmative, they attacked him with their skateboards and feet, kicking and hitting him. They broke six ribs before leaving him in the dust. The victim later identified two of the attackers as 16-year-old David McAuliffe. Shut up.
Can I finish the sentence before you? You can. Absolutely. Go for it.
And 17-year-old Sean Cushman. All right.
Why did I laugh at that?
Because that's the name of my father.
Yeah, your biological father. his name is David McAuliffe.
I had a slight heart attack until I did the math and realized that this McAuliffe was way too young. Cushman was a known leader of the Bondi Boys, and the victim should consider himself lucky that A, there were only three of them, and that B, they apparently couldn't be bothered throwing him off a cliff that night. In spite of positive identifications, no one was charged for the assault.
And that's, you know, when we talk about the inherent biases here, you've got a gay man who's been actively beaten up, has been able to identify his victims. Identify his attackers. We all know who they are, and yet no charges are laid. And that's because 1980s gay crimes were considered icky. They didn't want to talk about them. And Australia was not isolated in this. I brought up Jeffrey Dahmer earlier. The exact same thing happened there, where one of Jeffrey Dahmer's victims was actually returned to him by the police, who chalked it up to a gay tiff, you know?
I roll my eyes.
Yeah, so it's like that this is the general attitude that's held around the world at the time. Australia is not unique in this. It doesn't excuse the behaviour, but again, it's like it was a sign of the times.
3 days later, on December 21, 1988, 24-year-old cafe worker David McMahon was set upon after leaving the Bondi Iceberg. 18 young people, including some girls cheering, attacked him, knocking him to the ground. One of the Bondi Boys, later identified as Sean Cushman, was heard by Macon to call out, "Let's throw him where we threw the other one," as they dragged him towards the cliff's edge. McMahon took advantage of a distraction on his attacker's behalf and bolted, managing to get away. I think that's all the cases we're going to cover for today, but that is a fucking chilling way to leave it.
Absolutely. We're going to get into the last of the most famous cases on part three, and I would imagine part three will be the conclusion to this story.
Yes, it would, yeah.
I think I expressed my emotions regarding how I feel about this story in the previous episode, so we don't need to rehash that. But it's very important to remember the past so that we do not become doomed to repeat it. Before I let you guys go, maybe you have a connection to this case. We have had family members reach out to us many, many times when it comes to some of the cases we've talked about, and we would absolutely love to hear your perspective on it. Now, if you want to get in touch with us, you can shoot us an email to weirdcrapinaustralia@gmail.com. Just remember, though, if you send us information that we think could lead to an arrest, we will forward it on.
So if you don't want to do it.
Yeah, yeah. So be very, we won't ignore anything like that. This is an ongoing investigation. If you happen to send us any information that we think the police may need to hear, we will forward that on, absolutely.
I don't know whether that's a promise or a threat, but take it whichever way you want it to be.
Could be both. Could be both. Just remember that. But if you just like to send a fan letter like one of our lovely fans did this week, quick shout out to Veronica.
Victoria.
I'm so sorry, Victoria. I say that because my mother-in-law's name is Veronica, and I see that V, that E, and I immediately make an association. She sent us an email through just to tell us that she's still listening to the show and is a big fan. So
she's like, I'm sorry I haven't talked to you guys, but I'm still here.
And then she went through and liked a bunch of our posts. So thank you very much, Victoria, for getting in touch with us. We know you're still around, mate, and it's lovely to hear from you. I'm glad you're doing well out there. And thank you for the podcast recommendation as well. Thought that was pretty cool. I'll go check that out. Shoot us through a letter through our weirdcrapinaustralia@gmail.com address. You can also keep the conversation going on our Facebook page, Weird Crap in Australia, same as Instagram, and you can find us on Twitter. Our handle is @WeirdCrapInAuz. If you've been following me on Twitter, I did jump into the Batman controversy from last week, which I thought was very amusing. Just check out Twitter. Check out my Twitter. I put a lot of comments out there that I think are quite funny and sassy, which I'm sure Blake rolls his eyes at that comment, of course.
I'm pretty sure he's just got like a beep thing. Every time you say Batman, he just hits the beep thing.
Probably. Actually, he's done that. I guarantee he's now probably done that. He's probably just gone back over his editing and is now like beeping beep, out beep, every... Beep. Because of course he would do that.
People aren't going to know what word it is though, because he's going to beep them all out.
Absolutely. It'll be a mystery to solve. What else can we talk about? Of course we've got Patreon. That's how people can directly support our work. What we're doing now, with all of our books, with this podcast, it's definitely grown into a beast that we never expected it to grow into. And that's one of those things where we're trying to preserve as much Australian history as we can. We're trying to unearth as much as we can. And we do that via the vehicle of the weird and wonderful. People who support us on Patreon for as little as $5 a month, they get a bonus minisode each week. And they also get the episodes of Weird Crap in Australia completely ad-free. So if you listen to this free on something like Spotify, for example, you definitely will get an ad or two in the front, maybe one in the back, maybe one in the middle as well. The reason that we do that is so that we have funds to continue to buy equipment, to pay for services that we use, to just, buy research material. We like to buy out of print occult books, and they're very bloody expensive. Those books, for example, one of the books that we've used is Bill Chalker's The Oz Files, which was, I think, $50. Mm-hmm. It was a very expensive book to buy out of print, but we've turned that into about 4 or 5 episodes so far. So that's where a lot of the money goes to. We're definitely not lining our pockets because we, of course, are still working our day jobs.
Still full time.
Three years, and we're still working those day jobs. Big thank you, of course, to our Patreon supporters. And if you'd like to get in on that, just head to patreon.com, type in Weird Crap in Australia, get yourself some bonus content for as little as $5 a month. I've been having some discussions with Holly about extra content that we can bring to that. And I think I've got a cool idea. And once I actually sit down, commit to it and start recording it, I'm going to let you know. But little hint for those people who've always asked whether we will do audiobooks for Weird Crap in Australia Volume 1, watch this space. Patreon users, watch this space. What else have I got to talk about? Do you want a Weird Crap in Australia t-shirt? I've got 5 of them and I'm not bullshitting you. I love Ignacio's artwork so much that I always buy his t-shirts, Ignacio being the Weird Crap in Australia artist. If you'd like a Weird Crap in Australia t-shirt, head to weirdcrapinaus.redbubble.com. You'll be able to grab any one of Ignacio's amazing designs and slap it on a myriad of products, from t-shirts to coasters to stickers, to pretty much anything. They do a lot of shit on redbubble.com. Puzzles. They do puzzles now. I don't think none of our designs fit into a puzzle, but as soon as we do have one, I'll make that work.
And maybe you'd make it like super hard if there were like white bars at the top and bottom.
Exactly. you can grab yourself some Weird Crap in Australia merch. We're also going to hopefully in the very near future be announcing our very first physical location for Weird Crap in Australia merch. So watch that space as well.
That's about it.
Is it?
Yeah.
I feel like I have 3 things to plug, but that's only because I had to plug Killaroo, which you can still grab a copy of my upcoming graphic novel, Killaroo Semper Fidelius. Darren has launched the backer kit, so if you missed out on the Kickstarter we did, you can go pick that up. And of course, Weird Crap in Australia Volume 1, our first book, available from lulu.com. And on digital from amazon.com. Volume 2 comes out in September. So keep an eye peeled for that. And with that, Matthew is going to bed because he's had a very hard weekend at his day job. And it is, what is it, 2:14 a.m.?
Mm-hmm.
I'm tired.
I'm not.
Thank you for sticking with us. Oh,
and Talia says hi.
And as is traditional, Holly gets the final word.
Oh no, just saying that Talia said hi as well.
Yeah, that's pretty much it. Talia's little meow. That's what you get this week, folks. Well, that's it from us. We will have the conclusion to this story next week for you on Weird Crap in Australia. Bye for now.
Bye.
This has been a production of The Modern Meltdown. For more podcasts just like it, head to themodernmeltdown.net.